Thank you all for joining us. I appreciate you coming in. As I promised, free cookies. Free Emmy, Grammy, award winners, and rock stars, and platinum record awardees. So we'll get to that in a few minutes. I'm Steve Kerr. Exactly. I couldn't talk him into bringing them, though. Even for half an hour, they want to sit, so I don't think coming in with suitcases full of Grammys and Emmys is going to happen. But thank you and welcome. So I'm the founder of Scala Technologies. We're a new company. We're about a year old. Our objective has been to invent fundamental new ways to protect digital content. These gentlemen have used the product and have given us significant feedback as a part of the process. So we'll talk a little bit more about that. But most importantly, I'm not going to talk a lot about us. I'm going to talk more about what we believe we're observing industry-wise. Time for Q&A at the end, so feel free to pitch in and steer us in whatever direction you want to steer us. We appreciate it. Just 5 minutes of setup. This is what this is why we have a problem. Anyone know what that is? The Kentucky Volunteer. The first song ever copyrighted, 1794. We had a brand new constitution. Copyright law was instituted. Why didn't we worry about piracy? Well, the reason is, well, by the way, Andrew, for you, there's a part for the guitar.
Nice.
In 1794, the guitars. Well, this is why piracy was not a problem. This is what it took to copy. In the film industry, anybody recognize this? This is the first film ever recorded in Edison's lab. That's it. That was feature length. That was called Fred Ott's Sneeze. Fred Ott was some poor guy that worked in Edison's lab, and Edison wanted to test some equipment. That was the first film ever copyrighted, 1894, January, almost exactly 100 years after the first song was copyrighted. We're still not worried about piracy. Why? Because that's what a Kodi box looked like in 1894. You had to somehow get that strip out of there and figure out how to copy it. This is basically Netflix in 1894, so there was actually a version of the code of the kinetoscope that allowed you to project film at home. So what's happened? In 1995, much more recently, an HD film took $4,000 worth of storage in a typical PC to store, and it took 40 days to transfer, given then current internet rates. Remember, 300 baud, 1200 baud dial-up modems. Today, that same storage is roughly 12 cents on the same equivalent computer and 13 minutes to transfer across the internet. That's the fundamental problem. By 2022, all of us in this room are aghast to learn that projections are roughly $50 billion of stolen content anticipated. Now listen, this is 2018. We've got technology, we've got intelligence, we've got smart networks. You've got 30 companies out there protecting content, and it's going in the wrong direction. So our hypothesis is the industry continues to be plagued with vulnerabilities related to sharing content, collaborating around content, storing content, and we're committed to focus on those leakages to eradicate piracy as we know it. So now on to the panel. Andrew Bojanic, multi-platinum producer, songwriter. I guarantee you've heard his work. It's on CNN, it's on half the ads you listen to, it's in movies. He's so far been behind the console, just launched a rock band last year. We went to Whiskey A Go-Go, best rock concert I have ever been to. Literally, I went to a lot of rock concerts, my ears were damaged as a result, even further because of Andrews. He's worked with some of the biggest artists known in Emerald City Studios. He's obviously originally from Australia, as you can tell. Chris Sharma, Grammy Award-winning recording engineer. I call you legendary. His work with the Rolling Stones and dozens of other artists. He's one of our panel attendees that didn't bring his Grammy to sit on his knee. But you haven't brought it to restaurants yet, but you should. I love that hat. Oh, you must be Chris Sharma. And Cameron Frankley, Emmy Award-winning. Actually, Cameron couldn't just win one Emmy last year. He won two Emmys for the same show. I asked him, please leave an Emmy for somebody else at some point for the Beatles 8 Days a Week, and as a go-to sound designer for Warner Brothers films, and does a whole bunch of independent work. So that's our panel. And I had some cheater questions. Can you give me a screen, Jeanette?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. My questions are safe. So the point today is to discuss what the needs, the anticipated needs for content protection for those that are actually building and creating and handling that valuable content. And, you know, something that we've talked a lot about is this sense that the need for content security continues to grow compared to the past. And Andrew, I don't know if you want to start with that in terms of, as you're laying down tracks, what are some of the things you think about?
Okay. As I'm laying down the tracks, so how it's changed through
how it's
the process,
changed, actually. Yes.
Well, I guess over the last 10 years, the accessibility of the technology, people being able to now record at home, download things at home. 10 years ago, I was working with Krish, actually 15 years ago, in expensive studios where we would have to go in at an hourly rate, and you know, they would basically control all of the equipment. We would have a computer system at home, but I don't know, we'd maybe burn off some CDs or something and take them home because we were still on 33.6 dial-up, whatever it was. So I guess the technology has made the accessibility of kids now, we're dealing with them every day, they're downloading our music, stealing it off YouTube, uploading it to YouTube, doing whatever. This wasn't happening 10, 15 years ago, I guess, so now we're thinking of the security. Because we have no choice, this is how we make a living. This is how we all make a living, so.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Chris, some thoughts about some of the artists you work with?
You know, I worked with some, a lot of large artists, and you know, giving them experience, you know, is part of our job, and giving them experience of security is also part of that job. And I work with the Rolling Stones, and we people covet their content. And the first record I did with them, just as an assistant engineer, many, many years ago, I believe in '94. At the same time, they did that. They decided they had a bunch of outtakes from the past 40 years that they, at the time, wanted to archive and put onto different formats. And this was kind of back in the day before computers, digital tape had just come out, so they wanted to upgrade. And so the tape factory that they used, which was part of the studio that I worked at, someone ran a copy. And then that copy ended up going to a record label in Italy. And that Italian record label ended up putting out all this material as a professional product with covers on it. And that started, they made a lot of money from this piracy that took a lot of songs the Stones were planning on releasing later and took it out of their bailiwick. And it took their kind of whole idea of how to operate with their creative rights and their tastes and put that into a real place of insecurity for them. And so, even back then, the threat was there. You could make money from pirating content. But now, fast forward, not only is the threat that was there that they experienced, but now you fast forward, and it just takes one engineer somewhere, one IT person, to go to that hard disk that you have, and they can take that data off of it. And hard disk, you might have 50 of them. If you're doing a lot of takes, you're doing a lot of work. And so you end up with this situation where they're very insecure about their content, and you as the production entity, engineering entity that is making their creative content for them, you end up becoming responsible for that. And there's a lot of trust they have to put in you, but there's also a lot of liability and unspoken liability that we experience around that. And it's a constant issue, and there's constant fear. And you can't, don't burn a CD to give someone to go listen to a car. You can't do that anymore. You've got to control it. And it takes a lot of the effortlessness and the joie de vivre out of the process when you have to think about not letting it get stolen.
Yeah, great point. In fact, I remember Chris told me something early on, and I think, Cameron, you told me the same thing, that with the jobs you guys do, you lose control of content, you could very well lose your career, right? People just won't go to you anymore. And Cameron, one thought you shared with me earlier, a lot of the studios, a lot of you know this, were sort of air-gapping critical areas, either the post houses or computers that, it's a little like I can't solve the problem, so I'm just gonna lock down all the gates and we'll deal with it later, which creates all kinds of other superfluous problems. But Cameron, you had some good thoughts in terms of how that's ultimately is going to have to be modified.
The way things are operating now, how they used to, in the studio we would operate on networks behind a firewall, and that was our sense of security. And with all the infractions and viruses and stolen material, we've had to create a closed network within the studio network. So all of the workstations, the picture workstations, the audio workstations, can talk to each other and they can talk to a central server, but none of that can touch the internet. And along with that security protocol, none of the machines are allowed to connect to your USB drives, your FireWire drives. All of those ports are shut down. I think Sony went to the extent of actually putting glue in the ports, so you couldn't plug things in.
How do you update the software?
Well, then you get an engineer comes in and deals with that. But now they have a software that they'll put in the Pro Tools, the workstations, that will shut off the ports, and then they can open up ports to do updates and this and that. But you know, as it's secured things, oh, and then also to get new material into the network, it has to pass through an I/O station, a designated I/O station, which brings stuff in from the outside. It gets scanned for virus, and then it gets distributed to a server, and then it makes it through to the individuals. The whole workflow has changed dramatically.
So as you guys think about what these changes have meant, so I'm a relative newcomer to the entertainment industry, but it seemed to me initially my reaction was, gosh, there's a lot of collaboration, right? You know, you go to the film, you go to the movies and you see the, you know, Warner Brothers Pictures and you think, well, that's all a Warner Brothers film. But behind the scenes, I was actually shocked to find out you've got post houses and you've got video special effects and even the subtitlers and different language. So there's a ton of collaboration. So one question I have, both for music and film, I think for hip-hop music creation, there's a lot of collaboration. Andrew, you were telling me that instead of one or two writers, you might have 13 writers on one song, so there's obviously a ton of collaboration. I'm interested in all your thoughts in terms of, you know, how can that collaboration occur if you're in an environment where you've got nothing but fences? You know, it seems to me that we've got to find a way to solve the problem without the fences, because that collaboration, art is sort of a collaborative enterprise in many cases.
Absolutely.
You know, for us, you know, in music, and it's shameful to say, you know, and I've worked on a lot of big records, still the protection in the production phase is anonymity. It's hoping no one realizes what you're emailing around is something significant. You know, I was working on a record in Italy, and it was a great Italian artist. Bono wrote lyrics for a song for us. So Bono writes the lyrics, he sends them in an email. He records a song, it's on MP3, just in a regular email sent on Hotmail. And then we get it, you know, the assistant logs in because no one can figure out the Italian. But so this song, this is already all over the place. And the only thing we can depend on is that engineer is cool, and that all the other 50 million clients are gonna come through that studio and see the stuff that for sure never got deleted, is that they don't know what it is. And so funny file names and all that is just, yeah, that's not a solution, but because you have to collaborate, that's what it ends up being. And a lot of surprise in the high levels.
Cameron, thoughts about film? So you had mentioned sort of that I/O station, but it sounds like that's one possible solution. If you want to send something out, you can't send it to a destination in the current architecture. You send it to someplace where somebody...
Yeah, I mean, that whole architecture is designed to protect it once it gets in. Protect it coming in and then protect it once it's in. But when we send stuff out, we've been for many years using the Aspera servers, which is an encryption that is secure while it's in shipment. But when it leaves my office, it's in an unencrypted form. And when it lands, it's in an unencrypted form. And so like SCADA software would be very valuable because you can send an encrypted file, and until the person you intend to have it has the key, it can't be viewed. So, you know, the Bono lyric there is safe until the right guy.
Until the user who needs it.
The specific guy. Mm-hmm. And then he can lock it back up and leave it on the desktop. It doesn't really matter. It can, you know, it can be available to anybody, but without that encryption key. It's a bit like at the end of our process, when we release films, we use a DCP. It's internationally accepted encryption for theatrical films, and it works, and everybody likes it. This software does the same thing internally, point to point, that the DCP does.
Mm. Great point.
It's, you know what I mean? It's who's this intended for, open it, let them use it, and then lock it down. I mean, And even if you're trying to protect your own stuff, your own sessions, your own artistic endeavors, you can lock it down in the studio and sit on the desktop, and you can have six guys in there working. No one can open your sessions, see how you're doing stuff, listen to your work. I mean, it's...
That's exactly. You need to be able to protect with different levels. Some things, you know, if you're writing something and you're in the middle of it and it's horrible, you don't want anyone to be able to hear that. That's just yours.
I see the analogy, like, you park your car in your driveway, you still lock it and turn the alarm on. The odds of getting stolen are a lot less, but you'll sleep better.
Mm-hmm. And I think, as we've discussed before, in the music business, there's so many times that we have files either shifting around from person to person, or if we're in a commercial studio and things, you know, we give the assistant a hard drive, say, oh, here's the hard drive. They copy it onto their drive, and then we work off that drive, and then we go out for lunch, and then we might take our drive, but they've copied it onto their drive now. Now, if we could have a USB key or whatever it may be, our own key, so that if I leave the room, I rip it, everything's encrypted. I come back, it's encrypted, it's decrypted, you know. Or we have many, like we said, at the end of our project, say, we'll have a bunch of final mixes, and as we've discussed, that's when the material for us is the most valuable, because it's no longer thousands of little sound files, it is a stereo track that somebody can play and share around. We send that everywhere. Send it to a mastering guy, send it to a record label, send it to the manager, send it to the artist. Who knows who they're sending it to? So at least this way we can, with the SCADA software, we can pinpoint, you know, even to an IP, like an area, right? Even GPS. whatever it is, or I know that only Krish can open it, no matter where he is in the world.
That's the thing.
Or whatever it may be.
It's the key becomes a protected item versus, or the access is protected versus the content.
Exactly.
You know, and that's and that makes it a lot easier. You can be more free with it. Like, look, I'm going to send you all this stuff. You know, I'll send you the whole record pre-release, but here's just the key only for this single.
Well, like we're discussing with Cameron. Instead, we're no longer so worried about, you know, we use Dropbox a lot, or like I said, many of our artists would use any free sharing thing they can find. That's what they are sharing stuff with. We don't know if that's secure, but at least if we've encrypted it, then it doesn't matter. People can get hold of the file, they're never going to hear anything unless they have the key, right? So, makes sense to me. I mean, in its simplistic form, it makes sense.
So one of the things that I struggle with is the value of stolen content. So there have been lots of surveys, you know, presumably professional, well-vetted surveys. The number this year, as I put on the chart, was $30 billion. I think it's hard for me to fathom that much theft. So one of the things I'd love to hear you guys talk about, if you divide the world into the pre-release period, where the content's, you know, nobody's hit the send button. It's not been streamed, it's not been sent out to DCP projectors or any of that, versus the post-release period. Because there, you know, have been a ton of attempts in the DRM space to try to protect consumers, and that or protect against consumers copying stuff, and those have all failed in the past. So some thoughts would be helpful regarding your sense of the value of pre-release versus once it's been shipped out, because there's been a lot of discussion, you know. Let's put things on YouTube and let's give it away and let's live off the ads that are generated via, you know, pre-release, of course, it's probably never good to let it out. So some thoughts about that value number. That just seems massive to me.
One way to look at the value number is going to be kind of comprising both of what you're saying, but is within music only, it's very simple. Since the dawn of file sharing, gross revenues of the music business are down $35 billion. Period. And that's with all the improvements in Spotify and Apple Music, that's where we sit right now.
Wow.
And so we've lost just over half of the revenues that were coming in to music. And that includes touring and everything. Even touring's been up. But the recorded music used to drive this big, huge industry. And that has really been compromised by the security issue. And it's become a social issue. The fact that the security issue existed is what created the environment that you could have streaming for 0.007 cents for a song, which no emerging artist is ever going to make enough money to buy a cup of coffee with. And that set the stage for this whole business to become change now, but eviscerated it first. So the numbers start with this $35 billion in aggregate alone.
Yikes. Any questions from any of you that haven't covered?
Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. I've got two comments and a question.
Okay.
The first one is, Andrew, you have an amazing accent. Krish, you have fantastic hair. Okay.
And what's Cameron?
No, Cameron.
Let's just stick with that.
Keep the point.
You've got a great tan. Okay, so the question is, what do you mean by the end user with the encrypted key? How do you, what do you mean by that? How do you let that end user know what do you mean by that key?
Yeah, the way we look at that is there is no perfect answer. There is no way to ensure that something will never ever be copied. The only thing you can do is continue to build barriers. And I'm sorry to say that when I was younger, I was a prolific hacker. And so for me, it's, you know, you kick down, so we lock our doors at home. Anyone can kick down a wooden door. So you're really not protecting your house, you're just making it more difficult. But if I kick down the wooden door and I find a steel door behind it, am I going to then go find a hacksaw and cut through the steel door? If I get the steel door, I'm going to find a concrete door. I mean, at some point I'm going to give up. So the thought is, you know, sort of this first wave of security was around securing networks, which was necessary and essential. You've got to have a firm foundation. I mean, the theft that occurred at Larson Studios Post House was an open wireless LAN port that was undetected, and somebody was able to drive by every night at midnight and continue to download stuff. Okay, that had to get fixed. The next level is securing general hard drive network connections, you know, sort of at the infrastructure level. The next level is to, inside of that, the payloads themselves are encrypted using a different encryption technology, a different key, and that key is further protected by a password. And so
that's what you mean by a key, a password. So the end user is the only one. You call them and you say, "Hey, Jamie, the password is this," and then that's how they know to punch it in to get your content.
That's right. The password can be email. It can be.
But they need to have the key also.
That's right.
The thing that excited me originally when Steve told us of the new ideas I had. Is incorporating their we've only touched on the software at the moment, right? But the SCADA concept originally, they designed this amazing hardware technology, speakers basically, right? A new way of creating speakers. He can explain it all, but basically, the speakers are the final decrypting piece to the puzzle, right? The actual hardware, so they do all this software, they do all their encrypting, etc. with the software, which is working amazing, but then in conjunction with the hardware that they've created, that is actually the thing that then processes it in a different way, more of an analog way, I guess, and that decrypts it. And when I heard that, I was like, well, that's completely, like, unless you had a bunch of hardware engineers and a bunch of software engineers, which hackers just, I don't know, I wouldn't think they'd put that much time and money into it. So
they're going to go to another piece of
They're going to go somewhere else. So for us in the music world, now I kind of thought, well, now if every set of headphones and every computer and every speaker has a chip in it or whatever it may be, or this certain speaker they've designed, that is the decoder, then I, as a distributor, I could have my own distribution network where I'm sending out my music files. And also, these pieces of equipment, they're ID'd basically with your own key, right? Mm-hmm. So you could all have different speakers with their own key as part of it. I send out the file, and only if you have that key and that license, if you paid me for it, it'll decrypt. If not, it's just going to be a bunch of noise, mm-hmm. right? Or you'll be able to explain that better. But that's what excited me. That whole tying in the hardware with the software was just...
Yeah, and that combination of two things leads to, you know, innovation is all great and protecting things is wonderful, but we're in this environment, you know, where the barn is open and the horses are out, and this is a way to get some of the horses back, and there's a business case. where you can monetize premium content with technology like this in a way that you can start bringing back some of the desire.
Sure. And some as an artist, I could have an album and it's only accessible to members. And there is no way it can be copied. There's no way it could be played anywhere else except for your keyed hardware device. That's cool. I mean, that puts all of the time and effort and money that myself as a creator have put in, now that puts all of the control in my hands, because I can pick and choose. I can turn you guys on and off. It doesn't matter, what you do. You just can't break it. So I thought that was really cool.
So I have a quick question and a more open-ended one. So the quick question is this, I'm showing my age, sort of a dongle-based public-private key sort of security system? I mean, you mentioned DCPs. Is it the same sort of technology?
It doesn't require a dongle.
Oh, it doesn't
require? No, I have one. It can be used with dongle, so I store my keys on the
Oh, I see. So you're using it as like a...
They all have to have this.
Yeah, okay.
But the keys can be stored anywhere. You can store any file.
Okay, so that's just a keyword, like a password storage system.
Well, the key itself is a complex key, and the password protects the complex key.
Right, okay.
Like a license or a key.
Right, okay. And then my other question is, from the standpoint of, from the production environment, this makes a lot of sense, because that's where you're going to have a lot more control. But do you see, on the end user side, micropayments or blockchain being a technology likely to come into this space? Do you think that's going to change the way we distribute music?
That's a very cool question.
Well, there's a lot of people working on that, and hopefully, definitely, yes. Because blockchain, it's revolutionizing the publishing portion of music already, because people are going to be able to, there's no more, ASCAP says, only 3 people listen to your song, 4 million did.
Yeah.
And that's going to be, and you can probably speak better to this, that side of the business. But there's definitely a lot of advantage to be had to that. And if you can protect it on top of knowing who's using it, then that's the holy grail.
Yeah, we've been, the issue with blockchain is it's such a new technology.
Mm-hmm. And hard to explain.
And hard to explain. And we've spent a lot of time thinking about, as Chris said, kind of throughout the life cycle of a piece of valuable content, where does blockchain apply? Because it's really a public ledger that can be used to track things and manage, the entire history of that thing from the moment it was born, which seems to be a good kind of complementary fit with encryption. So we're thinking about it, but I'm not sure yet where it's going to
be. But it's kind of crowdsourcing your security in a way.
In a way, that's right. That's right.
But in that kind of environment, one of the problems that we're seeing in blockchain is there are dozens of different type of implementations of it and dozens of different type of ledgers. How do you see that being resolved, or how will that be resolved?
That's a really, really good question, and it's so embryonic from my perspective. I don't know if you guys have thoughts, but if you look at Ethereum allows you to build your own custom set of functionality around the blockchain technology. And what's happening, when it was just blockchain associated with Bitcoin, it was completely standard uniform. And you had the entire history of every transaction for every engine that's running on the network. With Ethereum, there are all these, flurry of variation. I think what's going to have to happen is someone's going to have to step up and begin to set some standards for the use of Ethereum.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I mean, that's where my logic heads. And it's like, all of a sudden, we've got ASCAP again being the whatever.
Do you have thoughts on that? Could we talk about this? Do you have thoughts on that? Could we connect? Are you asking, or do you have some ideas that we could connect with? Because I think it's a great question.
I think it's, I think small guy versus the big guy. I think it's the viability of the market versus, the creative side. And I don't know. I really don't know.
Okay. So feel free to touch base with us if you want to kind of brainstorm it, because it's something we're spending a lot of time thinking about.
I wonder if the tokenization of music with blockchain, when you add some kind of additional income flow from that, where, a lot of everyone's, tokenizing everything, if there was an additional way to attach sponsorship or to attach something to this world, I think then blockchain and the tokenization make a lot more sense, because that motivate artists to use it because it's another revenue source.
Yeah, it's a way to align incentives.
But you were mentioning that, you know, with the custom speakers, that you could really have like a cool kids club where only certain people could use the content. And so maybe there's a sense of rarity and exclusivity that could be built into this ledger system to sex it up a little bit. I don't know.
I mean, look at the number of believers or Swifties.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, these clubs have come up around artists. Any other questions before you get the punchline?
Oh.
So, a recording engineer, producer, and sound designer walk into a bar. That's going to happen in about 3 minutes. They agree on one thing. It's Laurel. Have all of you heard that? So before I kick on the music. Oh, can we turn? You hear Laurel or do you hear Yanny?
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
Now turn down the bass.
Yeah.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
It's more behind.
So thank all of you. I appreciate your time. Have a wonderful afternoon. And the beer's on me.